This is Car Expert.
So the company now has the credentials where it launches a second pocket rocket and people are going to take it bloody seriously.
Fuel standards is a substantial issue. We're constantly in touch with the government about this.
Being able to enjoy the car and also being able to do all the practical stuff you need to do with a big car is just perfectly nailed in the Superb.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner, and g'day to Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy.
And also joining us on the panel this week is the young Scott Colley.
Hello, guys.
Now, guys, when we usually talk about Chinese cars, they're mostly SUVs, but Moco, this week you've been driving a Chinese van. What is it, and what's it been like?
Yeah, so it's called the LDV Deliver 9. LDV was a British company, Leyland DAF, that got sold to the SAIC Motor Group, which is a partially Shanghai government-owned company that also owns the MG brand, which is doing great things in Australia. LDV has the T60 pickup and the G10 van, both of which are doing pretty well. This one is the biggest van that it offers. It's kind of a Ford Transit or a Volkswagen Crafter, Mercedes-Benz Sprinter, that really big van space, and it undercuts all of the Euros by a significant chunk of change and doesn't really go without anything inside either. So it's got a 10-inch screen, it's got autonomous braking inside airbags, rubber in the cargo area, it looks the part, it's got an in-house 2-litre diesel engine that's got more power than the equivalent priced Mercedes Sprinter does. So really throwing a cat amongst the pigeons, especially considering van buyers are so sensitive to price and cost of ownership, and they're not really married to brands. If a van's going to do a job and save them money, they're probably going to buy it. So I think this is something that the LDV brand could really hang its hat on. And I have to say, and I know that Paulie Marich spent some time in it doing a video as well and said a similar thing, which is this is actually a pretty good van. It's actually not doesn't do a hell of a lot wrong. There are a couple of little gremlins here and there, but by and large, for what you pay, it's a heck of a lot of van for the money. And every time I drive a Chinese car, it's better than the one that preceded it by a significant margin. And, you know, we're really at the point now where the product is, you know, doesn't need to just be half the price. It's actually pretty good on its own merits.
Marco, some brands you pay more attention to the practicality of a van and not so much more attention to the cabin and the interior where the driver sits most of the time. How does this van pair up with that?
Well, there are a couple of quirks. So by and large, it's really nice. It's you sit up super high. You've got storage cubbies everywhere. The build quality is no worse than what a Renault Master would have, for instance, which means it's just fine. Huge screen, pretty grainy reversing camera, unfortunately. But the ergonomics are generally okay, except for the fact that it does have a hydraulically assisted steering system, and you can actually see part of the hydraulic steering system's componentry running behind the brake pedal. Usually that's hidden away. So where you go to rest your foot, because it's an automatic, you actually pretty much touch your foot against the actual steering mechanism itself, which the company hasn't tried to hide. Now, I am fairly confident this is a left-hand drive to right-hand drive issue. So obviously, being a Chinese company, they're more focused on left-hand drive than right-hand drive. And I think they've probably, maybe not as elegantly solved this problem as they could have. A bit of a quirk, no doubt. But, otherwise, a pretty nice place to spend time. And given that van drivers spend more time behind the wheel than anybody, that's pretty important.
What about the outside, Moco? It's got quite an aggressive, expressive design for a van, which are usually pretty bland.
Yeah, well, it does. It looks a lot like the Ford Transit, actually, doesn't it? And not the Transit Custom that we see everywhere, but the full-size Transit. There's not a lot of design now so you can really impart on a box on wheels when you think about it, but this one has a huge grille and some side sculpting running along it, and they've made a little bit of an effort for it to stand out. It replaces LDV's V80 in the range, which, quite frankly, was cheap and not even slightly cheerful. So it's a huge evolution on that front. And, you know, if you pull up at your toll warehouse in this and the other blokes there have got Crafters and Sprinters, you're not going to look ridiculous, which is a pretty important consideration.
You said at the beginning, the price is obviously much more affordable than the Euro counterparts. How much are we? How much difference are we talking?
Yeah, so $45,000 drive away for the long wheel base auto. If you're a fleet buyer, you'll get that down to just over $40,000 using an ABN. So an equivalent Renault Master that's the same size is at least 50. The base Mercedes Sprinter is 55, and that has less power and significantly less cargo space. The only one that really comes close is the Volkswagen Crafter Runner, which is selling at the moment for around the $50,000 mark with an ABN, but it's got a manual gearbox. So there's really nothing out there that's this big, 6 meters long, with 11 cubic meters of cargo space and an automatic gearbox going for $45,000 or around 40 for ABN buyers. You're really going to have to buy, you know, a used version to compete with it. It would be nice if LDV offered a better warranty than 3 years. MG, the sister brand, has a 7-year warranty, and it's a bit silly that LDV is persisting with this fairly undercooked 3-year warranty. But the choice really isn't cross-shopping the LDV against a new competitor. It's against comparing it with a 2 or 3-year-old competitor with maybe 100,000 Ks on the clock. And when you start to think about it in those terms, it sort of does make a bit of sense, I think.
Time for this week's dose of car news. And Scully, we have a new world's fastest car.
We do, and I notice you've left it to me to pronounce its name first. So I'm going to try my best here. But the SSC Tuatara hit 533 kilometres an hour in one direction, 484 kilometres an hour in the other direction, for an average of 508.6 kilometres an hour, which is just absolutely remarkable. They did it on a closed stretch of road in Nevada with a World Endurance Championship driver behind the wheel. And there's a video on carexpert.com.au right now. The way that the horizon just like comes through the cabin and shoots out the back at 500 kilometers an hour is incredible. It's like the world's on fast forward, and then the fast forward is fast forwarded again. It's absolutely crazy. As you would expect, something that fast is pretty damn powerful. It's got a twin turbo 5.9 litre V8 engine with 1,305 kilowatts on E85. Apparently, you can also run it on normal pump gas, but it will only make about 1,000 horsepower, which, you know, you're losing to Polos off the line, the lights and that sort of thing with that. You wouldn't bother. And apparently it could have gone faster if there was no crosswind. Actually said there was definitely more in there with better conditions. I know we could have gone faster. So I have no idea how mad you would have to be to keep your foot in until 530 kilometres an hour before going, a little bit sketchy now, boys, but it's going to back out. But yeah, race drivers are a different breed, aren't they?
Oh, you're so right, because I had a look at that video and you can see how comfortable Oliver Webb is behind the wheel at 530-odd Ks an hour. He is just so calm, so collected. And you can see when he backs off the throttle when he reaches that speed, it's something like 300 Ks an hour. He's doing fist pumps, so he's only got one hand on the steering wheel.
One of the things I remember really clearly from Top Gear when James May drove the Bugatti Veyron was what he was saying about how it changed his perception of speed. And he was saying that after hitting 400 kilometers an hour, he came back and went to open the door and get out because his mind was so warped. He didn't realize he was doing 120 Ks an hour when he tried to do that. I just wonder what your perception of speed would be like after doing 530. Even in the desert, there's, you know, cat's eyes and lane markings and things off in the distance to make it feel fast. So I just, like, I wonder what the 60 kilometre an hour drive home felt like for him.
The other thing that trips you out, and I mean, the fastest I've ever driven is that 300 mark, a tick over, but is the fact that the tiniest inputs into the car at that speed yield tremendous outputs. So you can turn the steering wheel seemingly 1 degree and it can fundamentally, you know, change what the car is doing because everything is sort of sped up. So I can only imagine going 500 k an hour. If you so much as breathed on the steering wheel, you'd pretty much completely lose control. So it must have a hell of a lot of downforce. I know that SSC, the brand that makes this, and Scully, you can probably tell me more, but it was formerly Shelby Supercars, right? So this is actually part of the Shelby Group, an American mob.
Yeah, so it's run by someone whose surname is Shelby. I actually don't know the full history of it, but I think from what I understand, there might have been a legal battle tied up in the use of the Shelby name. This is off the top of my head. I'm not quite sure. But they've actually been the maker of the fastest car in the world before. They had the SSC Aero. And a lot of the talk about the Tuatara, along with the fact it has a wildly powerful V8, is about how clever its aerodynamics are. If you look at it, it's got a very long, low nose. And I mean, it doesn't look like a Prius, but it shares actually some design elements and profiles with aero car, with eco cars, which also need to be very efficient. So, yeah, the amount of work that must have gone into making it stable and planted at that speed is pretty crazy. It's one of those ones where, and it's sort of something that I'm hopefully going to put on, now I've said it on the podcast, I have to put it on my list of things to do. But we'd love to chat to them about how they did it, because I want to spend hours talking to the people who designed a car that fast about how they did it and what inspired them to do it.
Mate, if you do that interview and don't let Crawford in, he'll kill you. I mean, this has got Crawford all over it, doesn't it? Our beloved.
I just don't know if we need Crawford telling them he's gone faster.
For the benefit of our listeners who are probably Googling at home wanting to find out more about this car, it's the letters SSC and the car is spelled T-U-A-T-A-R-A, Tuatara. Go and check it out.
Yeah, definitely worth having a look. Moko, the Hyundai i30 sedan, we now have pricing and specs for this car.
Yeah, slightly more prosaic, really, isn't it, the Hyundai i30 sedan compared to the SSC Tuatara, but it's not without its interest. So the i30 hatchback is obviously a pretty well-known quantity. The company used to sell a sedan called the Elantra, which was always unfair in the sales race because the Corolla and the Mazda 3 have always counted the sedan and the hatch together, and now Hyundai can too. So this car is the Elantra in some markets, but it's i30 sedan here, and it's got very different styling to the i30 hatch because it's a new generation car and it has this incredibly edgy design. It's sort of got these creases on the side that look a bit like what, you know, if you make a paper plane and then you unfold the paper and it's got those lines on it, it kind of looks like that. Really bold grille, edgy, sharp. You know, it's distinctive as all hell. Some people will love it, some people won't, but at least it's interesting. More roomy than the hatchback, although the i30 hatch is one of the more spacious in the class. This is even bigger again, particularly in the boot. There are a couple of grades available. So there's the Active that kicks off at 24,790 before on roads. Then there's the N-Line, which is the sort of hotted up one with a 1.6-litre turbo engine and independent rear suspension. And then you've got the N-Line Premium, which has that same warmed up drivetrain package and dual clutch gearbox with a few more luxury features. And that tops out at 37,290, really taking on the likes of the Honda Civic sedan, the Mazda 3 sedan, the Toyota Corolla sedan, and of course the Kia Cerato from fellow Korean brand Kia. I love the interior of this car. So the N-Line is nice, but it's actually the Elite, the mid-grade one with their naturally aspirated 2-liter engine, whose cabin I like the most. It's got these really interesting trims, kind of looks like almost like a Scandinavian feel in a sense to the sort of light gray and white trims that are being used throughout. It's got a really interesting four-spoke steering wheel, a large sort of integrated driver's instrument and infotainment display mounted side by side, really noticeable driver-facing orientation. Yeah, if you told me that this was the interior of the new Mercedes-Benz CLA or BMW 2 Series Grand Coupe, I actually wouldn't disbelieve you. It's that nice. I haven't sat in it in person yet. I'm just going off the pictures. But, man, it looks like a huge step up for that segment. And the fact that it's quite affordable will I reckon, potentially, you know, put a bit of interest back in the sedan market. People are mad for SUVs, but maybe it's time that the humble three-box sedan made a bit of a comeback. And if they all look as interesting as this one, there's probably a good chance they will. What do you guys think about it?
I think it's really interesting that Hyundai has, for one, called this an i30 because it now means that there's a difference between the i30 hatch and the i30 sedan that's quite significant in the way they look and the way they're equipped inside. But, yeah, I think this is the way forward for sedans like this. The market's shown that people want SUVs if they want practicality, which really frees brands like Hyundai up to do cool stuff with their sedans. I'm just trying to think of some natural competitors to it because I know that there are, you know, Honda Civic sedan is the main one and there are a few others, but none of them are really as overtly like style focused as the i30. And so, yeah, especially in N-Line trim, which is pictured in the story, it almost looks more like a Mercedes CLA competitor, the way that it's all put together. I'm going to be really interested to get it on the ground in Melbourne and actually see it side by side with the Civic, which is not a bad looking car itself, but it's going to be interesting to get it on the ground side by side with the Civic and see how it compares, because the Civic's not a bad looking car itself, but the Hyundai seems to have even more style to it and go even further down that coupe path.
Yeah, and it's interesting. A lot of brands have chosen to make their hatchbacks their style leaders. The Mazda 3 is a good example. It's got the really edgy, bold styling that puts looks ahead of practicality. And the sedan is there to sort of be that more practical, sensible choice. But Hyundai has gone in the complete opposite direction, and it's made the i30 hatch its kind of plain Jane, you know, inoffensive offering. And the sedan is the style leader. So, you know, Hyundai has gone against the grain, as it were, and I think this car really deserves to do well. I don't know whether consumers are going to rush back to sedans in droves, but I think this car has a chance to at least get a few people out of their SUVs.
Well, we're going to stick to Hyundai news. The Hyundai i30N's little brother, the i20N, has now been officially revealed, and I'm just as excited for this than the i30 sedan. We don't have details on pricing or equipment yet for this little thing, but we will see it here in Australia in the first quarter of 2021. We do know it has a 1.6-litre four-cylinder engine with 150 kilowatts and 275 newton metres of torque. With only a six-speed manual transmission, it can do to 100 kilometres an hour in 6.7 seconds. Launch control is standard, and you can choose to have it with a mechanical limited slip diff that Hyundai calls the N-corner carving differential, which I absolutely love. And Hyundai's even been more creative with these sort of names. The driving modes are selectable through the cheekily named N-Grin control system. I just love that. So like the i30N, the i20N has a rev matching feature, which is one of the coolest features on the i30N, so I'm pretty excited about that. You've got a choice of six colors, the amazing performance blue, there's intense blue, polar white, sleek silver, brass, and phantom black, and they're all available with a phantom black roof. The i20N comes with Hyundai's Smart Safety Suite, Smart Sense Safety Suite, I should say, including, you know, AEB, pedestrian and cyclist detection, lane following assists, intelligent speed limit assist, lane keep assist, so on and so forth. So it sounds like a very well-packaged car. Now, what do you guys think of the looks of the i20N?
Well, I think it looks $1 million. It's got a really nice edgy design to it. And it's a shame that the other i20 models won't be coming to Australia and it's just going to be the hot one. And I think this car has the credentials now. Hyundai is established with the i30N. You know, it poached the boss of BMW's M division, Albert Biermann, and it built a giant facility near the Nürburgring to really go hard on making its N-badged vehicles proper hot hatches. And the i30N blew everybody away with how good it was. And so the company now has the credentials where it launches a second pocket rocket and people are going to take it bloody seriously, and as they should. And I think in a bigger sense, I mean, that part of the market is extraordinarily interesting now. You've got the Ford Fiesta ST in its latest incarnation. You've got the Volkswagen Polo GTI. You've got this Hyundai i20N. Slightly higher up the price band, you've got the bonkers 200-kilowatt Yaris GR from Toyota. Most of these cars have a kind of WRC homologation feel about them, so they're a bit of a throwback to the 90s in that sense. And the fact that, you know, some of the smallest cars on the market are now some of the most interesting is I think one of the really big stories that we're going to see in 2021. And I absolutely cannot wait to get this on a track compared to those aforementioned rivals.
I think the i20N, I don't disagree with anything Moko's just said. So I've got something else on the i20N I think we should look at, and that's the fuel filler flap. Okay. I think the i20N proves that we're in a sweet spot for small hot hatches, and I also think it proves we're in a sweet spot for neatly integrated fuel flaps. If you look at the photo on Car Expert of the car's profile, look how well that filler flap is integrated into the brake light.
In the brake light, really? Oh, I need to have a look at this.
It's something that a few brands are trying to do at the moment. And the reason I say this is, yeah, I agree with everything Mike said. I think it sounds fantastic and I can't wait to drive it. But yeah, the little details on this look really well thought out as well. Look at how the fuel filler flap is neatly integrated into the bodywork around the brake light. And if you're listening to this, obviously, carexpert.com.au, the link to this story is in our podcast post. I know this doesn't make for great radio, people listening going, wow, that does look good. But trust us, edgecarexpert.com.au. We are in a sweet spot for small hot hatches, as Mike has said. We're also in a sweet spot for neatly designed fuel filler flaps.
Just to give you a little bit of, you know, context, those listeners out there that want to know what its bona fides are, it's got Pirelli tires and new anti-roll bars, springs and shocks over the car it's based on, 40 millimeter larger diameter front discs. It's got a quicker steering system, so the ratio has dropped to 12 from 12.4. It's got launch control and it's got a front wheel or front axle limited slip diff. So when you have a look at the credentials of this thing, this is not just some shopping trolley with a big engine stuck up the front. Hyundai has given this all of the treatment that it needs. And those driving modes you mentioned before, Mandy, the grin control, that doesn't just change the throttle calibration, but that also changes the stability control, the exhaust sound from the variable exhaust, and the steering resistance and sensitivity off center as well. So, I mean, this car really does appear to be the package. And if it can be priced around the same point as that Fiesta ST, so just north of 30 grand, which is going to have to be. Damn, what a car.
Ooh, I know. Yeah.
Our Tony Crawford has driven it already, and he, along with everyone else who drove it at Wakefield Park in Sydney, came away very, very impressed. So, yeah, it's got all the credentials, doesn't it?
Well, now going from small car to big car, Scully, the 2022 GMC Hummer EV has been revealed. I'd never thought I'd live to see the day of a Hummer being electric.
By the time we push our podcast live, we'll have a story live on the site written by one of our contributors, Thanos, about all the cars that the original Hummer H1 inspired, and none of them are even remotely clean or green. So the fact that there is an electric Hummer now is a real departure, and it's really, really cool. This is GM's answer to the Tesla Cybertruck and the Rivian R1T, and it's got some really, really impressive numbers. It's going to hit 60 miles an hour in about 3 seconds in its fastest mode. It's got a claimed range of 563 kilometers. And in the version that is going to launch after the first edition, is going to have 596 kilowatts of power. And it's got a wheel torque figure of 12,880 newton meters. Ignore that torque figure because it's not the same way everyone else measures torque. It's a multiplied version, essentially. But regardless, it's going to have plenty of pulling power. Inside, it's taken the approach that most electric car makers seem to be taking at the moment, and that's a lot of screens and a really minimalist design. But because this is a Hummer and a GM truck, it needs to look tough. And there's some really cool stuff like big sort of bronze grab handles and really neat detailing across the dashboard. And under the skin, it's really clever as well. So the Hummer EV actually has something that's called crab walk, and you're able to turn the rear wheels and the front wheels at the same angle at low speeds diagonally, so that rather than having to do a three-point turn or maneuver, you can just drive like diagonally across as if it's a shopping trolley, essentially. Really, really clever idea, and there's some of these things that some of them are allowed by electric motors, other allowed by clever engineering or a combination of the two, that are starting to pop up on these electric off-roaders that are really quite cool and make life easier. I know Rivian's working on a tank turn function, which will let you spin on the spot by running the left motors in one direction and the right motors in another. There's also a mode on the air suspension which raises the car by 149 millimeters if you need to get over an obstacle.
Wow.
Which sounds like an extension of the Mercedes GLE with its really clever bouncing air suspension. So as a sort of flagship truck that it seems like GM's thrown absolutely everything it has at the Hummer. In terms of Australia, we don't know whether it's coming yet. We contacted GM Specialty Vehicles yesterday to see if they had anything to say, and although our fingers were crossed, they'd say, yes, it's coming. We weren't expecting much. And they've said that it's only for North America to start with, but they also didn't rule it out. So if you really, really want one, maybe it's worth getting on the blower to GM Specialty Vehicles and trying to put some pressure on, because I think this is a ute that would look really good in Australian roads.
I think what's really interesting about this is obviously the car itself, but also we're seeing brands, I guess, taking shortcuts to make electric vehicles cool by applying some of their most cool or iconic badges and brands to them. So obviously there's the Ford Mustang Mach-E and the F-150 electric car would be great examples that would come to mind. And now the Hummer as well. And if you go to Europe, you've got, you know, Volkswagen's promised an electric version of its combi van, its next generation combi van. So I think there's a bigger story here, which is making EVs cool by tying famous badges to them. And I think the idea of being able to own a Hummer and not feeling guilty about the fact that your car is killing the planet by exhausting all the leftover dinosaur juice is probably going to give it a real fillip. And it actually makes that vehicle relevant again. Because let's be honest, outside of a small clique of military enthusiasts, the Hummer hasn't really been relevant for a very long time, at least to my tendencies. And this fundamentally changes that overnight. So pretty amazing effort, really.
And that wraps up this week's car news. You can click that car news link at carexpert.com.au to read more on those stories. Moko, this week you had a chance to talk to the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, the FCAI boss, Tony Weber. Obviously, with COVID-19, you couldn't see him in person, but what sort of things did you talk to him about?
Yeah, so the FCAI is the chief lobby group for all of the car manufacturers in Australia that sell their vehicles here. And it's always good to keep briefed with the FCAI just to sort of know where the industry's at. We had a really wide-ranging conversation that I've actually drummed up into a Q&A that is now live on carexpert.com.au, so you can go and find that. Tony Weber is his name, Tony, W-E-B-E-R, so Google that and check it out. But the snippet we're going to play now talks about the challenges of 2020. Obviously, COVID has been a nightmare, especially down here in Melbourne. So talking about the fundamentals of the economy, if we think car sales can bounce back to where they were. And then we delve a little bit into the innovations that we've seen coming out of COVID, particularly in the realms of digital retail. You know, we've seen a bit of a change in the way people buy their vehicles, contactless models and things like that. So we got some thoughts from him around that. And I thought he had some really interesting things to say. So, yeah, hope you enjoy it.
I guess from the other viewpoint, from an optimistic perspective, what are some pluses do you think that the industry can take out of 2020? Obviously, many people have had to fundamentally rethink how we do business. Has this driven innovation and positive change in some ways? I mean, digital retail is one example that probably comes to mind.
Yeah, well, I think right across the economy, we've all learned how to do things differently by necessity. And I think that is going to not drive change, but I think it's going to accelerate change. You've seen right across the economy, apart from myself, that is, how people actually consume has changed dramatically in the last 5 years. Buying online has become very popular, and the whole notion of actually how we consume is changing, and it's changing quite rapidly. And I think this will just accentuate that change. So for us, contactless buying, consumers' needs are changing. They don't need to go to the local department store anymore. They're happy to buy online. And that also goes across to our sector. So, you know, the traditional franchising model that has been in place since the end of the Second World War, it was going to evolve anyway. I think the evolution of that will be pushed forward by these experiences because consumers are demanding it. And we have the technology, and we've proven that technology is really capable and trustworthy. We will move on. And as a sector, we need to be along with the rest of the economy and move on and do things differently. And that's natural because that's what consumers want. Not just for cars, but buying shoes or jeans or even their groceries. The world's changing, and the automotive sector has to move on. And we can't be a group of staid old men sitting around, you know, well, this is how we used to do it in the 70s. The 70s are well gone.
Well, on the topic of innovation, we're seeing, I guess, Australia missing out on a growing list of green-friendly vehicles. You know, car brands are sending their supply of EVs to regions where the demand is stimulated a bit more by the government or the fleet sectors. And then you've got the other side of things being our petrol quality standards, which seem to be a roadblock to some Euro 6 vehicles selling here. The term dumping ground is one that I'm sure you've heard 100,000 times. Around fears that we're going to start getting models made for developing markets and missing out on the latest tech because we're just not a market that's prepared to incentivize it. Is there truth to this in your mind? And are there, you know, some sort of broad solutions that the FCAI can propose? I mean, you've obviously got that CO2 log that you're running now, which is one great example, but are there other things that can be done?
So I recognise what you're saying. I think one of the most important things about the Australian market, it is incredibly competitive. And if you go back to what actually drives markets, it's competition. And when you have strong competition, who wins? Consumers. And that's a good thing. And if you go back and look at the history of Australian politics and policy development in this space, you naturally go back to the Button Plan. And the Button Plan was really about pushing competition in the marketplace so that you get reduced prices and as much competition as possible. And we've ticked those boxes. Now, there's been some consequences along the line. So fuel standards is a substantial issue. We're constantly in touch with the government about this. It goes to a broader issue across the economy that you'd be well aware of, Mike. We need to do whatever we can. Limited resources of low emission vehicles will go to markets that have standards to meet. We recognise that. But ultimately, over time, that issue will be addressed as the supply constraints out of the factories are addressed and more low emission vehicles come into the market. Now, the other advantage of competition is brand A wants to get a leg up on brand B, and that will drive the pull to get those low emission vehicles into the Australian market and into the hands of Australian consumers. So we recognise there's a lot of work to be done here. Our CO2 target that we announced earlier this year is part of that strategy to actually address it, but it's not going to be the absolute solution. We need to keep working with governments. We understand the difficulties they face. We understand the problems with the refining industry here. We need to make the best of what we can do and get the best possible product into the hands of Australians, because they are demanding more and more electrified vehicles, and you see that in our sales figures.
Takata airbags, biggest recall campaign of all time, a staggering mess for car companies and the FCAI and everybody else to tidy up. Obviously, the IsMyAirbagSafe.com.au site has done great things in building awareness. What's the state of play with the Takata recall saga in Australia now? How close are we to being able to wrap this up?
Yeah, we're just waiting on the ACCC for final figures, but we think ballpark we got about at the 1st of October, probably around about 90,000 vehicles left.
Right.
Of the 3.2 million.
And they're beta bags only at this stage, I imagine, right?
There may be some, that's a mixture now from betas, right. 99% of them would be betas, but yeah.
Extraordinary effort.
It has been quite a remarkable program, and I know our website is My Airbag Safe. We've had over 11 million visits, and whilst there might be some people have done that multiple times, we know that, but when you think there's 17 million cars on the road in Australia, that's quite an extraordinary number of visits. So, but we are absolutely committed to finalising this. We want to work with the regulators to take these, to get these cars sorted. And we also want to work with the state registration authorities, because most people react to it, but there are some people, for whatever reason, have industrial deafness to this issue. But it needs to be addressed. It's such a significant safety issue. It needs to be addressed. We need to get those last 90,000 off. And we want to work with governments right around Australia, especially state registration authorities, to get those cars off the road.
And then the final question today, Tony, a little bit more levity. Have you reached out to VinFast, the Vietnamese company that bought the Holden Proving Ground? They've opened up a engineering centre down here, and they've started poaching ex-Holden staff left, right and centre. They obviously haven't talked about selling cars in Australia, which is where the direct involvement would come. But nevertheless, there's a lot of people that are quite interested in what they're up to. Have you reached out to anyone in that company by any chance?
We don't talk about our relationships with members and prospective members. Might be a good try, though.
Yes, indeed. That's it. Thank you, Tony.
Yeah, no worries, Mike.
It's no secret, just about every motoring journalist loves a good wagon, and Skoda wagons are right up there with the best. Scully has been scooting around in a Skoda Superb Scout, and he would love to tell you all about it. Scully, what's the difference between just the standard Superb and the Superb Scout?
The Superb Scout is slightly better at helping old ladies cross the road and 120% better at tying knots than a normal Superb. So the Scout is to the Skoda Superb what the Subaru Outback is to the Liberty, essentially. It's a higher riding, slightly tougher looking version of the standard wagon. It's got 150 mil of ground clearance, so it's not quite a full-on SUV, but it's more capable of tackling driveways and speed bumps and that sort of thing than the standard wagon, and it looks a bit tougher as well.
Have we had this here in Australia for very long?
We haven't. So it only came out earlier this year, about 4 months ago. And Skoda originally said it was going to be a limited edition. We were only going to do 300 of them. But based on the fact that everyone who drove one has liked it so far, and also that they could actually get them for 2021, it's now been added to the full-time roster. So next year, when the new Scout range arrives, there's going to be a Sportline sedan, a Sportline wagon, and then the Scout at the top of the range.
What sort of pricing are we looking, comparing it to just the Superb?
So it is slightly more expensive than the Superb sedan, but slightly cheaper than the Sportline wagon. It was, when we first tested it, listed at $59,490 before on-road costs. But Skoda has redone its pricing for 2021, and as a part of that reshuffle, it's moved the price to $61,990 before on-road costs. The reason for that price upgrade is that it's added some equipment to it. So it gets some stuff it didn't previously get, like a tow bar and I believe a sunroof as well, which was previously an option. No, excuse me. It gets a tow bar and a new sports steering wheel and the latest infotainment system with wireless Apple CarPlay.
Okay. What do you think of its styling?
I think it looks good. Like you said at the start, I'm a sucker for a good Skoda, like most motoring journos, and I think this is probably one of the better-looking Skodas out there. It's got really classic wagon proportions, but it's a little bit tougher because it's got lots of black cladding and metal add-ons. I'm not a huge fan of the metal skid plate at the front, but every now and again, if you look at it from the right angle, it looks like an Audi, and there's some really cool little lighting signatures and details on the exterior. When we were allowed to go and see people in Vic, I actually parked it in a friend's driveway, and his old man is a real car nerd like I am. And he walked up to the car and looked at the bonnet line, which is quite sharply creased and cuts quite hard into the wheel arch. And he walked along it and went, "Oh, wow, look at that metalwork," which is a very nerdy thing to notice if you're listening, Tony. But it also, it sort of shows that there's a lot of really neat details in this. And even the way that the bonnet cuts into the grille, it's quite understated, but if you look at it as a whole, it's really nicely put together, which kind of sums the car up really well. I think on the inside, it's very similar. It's, understated and well put together and stylish without shouting about it too much.
And then in terms of the way it goes, Scully, 200 kilowatt turbo engine, DSG transmission and all-wheel drive, if I'm not mistaken. So it obviously doesn't hang about, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so it's a big car, and I think traditionally this is the sort of car that we would have looked at with a diesel engine, because that was always the case. If you want a big, comfy cruiser, you want, a diesel engine with lots of torque. But the Volkswagen Group is among, one of quite a few manufacturers now that are so good at getting a lot out of a small displacement petrol engine.
Gee, I wonder why the Volkswagen Group doesn't want to do diesels anymore.
That's really weird, actually. I can't think of a reason. That's odd.
Yeah.
Speaking of Volkswagen, Scully, would you prefer this over a Golf all-track?
I would. So the Superb is much bigger than the Golf, for one, and the engine in this one is quite unique. In Australia, it actually is the only Skoda, that was the first Skoda, excuse me, to have a petrol particulate filter, which is essentially a filter that sits between the engine and the exhaust, and it catches all the nastiest emissions and burns them off when it fills up, which is something that all the diesel cars in Australia now need to do, but isn't necessary to meet our emissions standards. It sort of sounds silly, but I actually, the reason that Volkswagen doesn't do it on its mainstream cars, and a lot of the European Volkswagens like the Golf and the Skoda Scala and that sort of thing have the PPF now, the reason Volkswagen doesn't do it in Australia is that our petrol, the lower quality 91 octane fuel, has a lot of sulfur in it compared to what's allowed in Europe. And if you drive the car and fill it with 91, it's depending on who you ask, how long it'll take is a bit different. But essentially, in a few fills, you could have a really expensive repair bill on your hands because the filter is clogged. So this is quite a it's a quite a high-end product for Skoda. And because of that, compared to the Golf All-Track, it gets a bigger engine. It gets the higher tech powertrain because essentially Skoda trusts the owners to put the right fuel in it. And it also gets some other stuff that I really like. And, you know, I think if you're buying a Skoda, you're aware of this, but really neat stuff like all of the boot netting, the umbrella in the door, the bin in the door. There's lots of those touches that, even though we don't like repeating marketing slogans, kind of make this thing simply clever.
I think it also says a lot about Skoda's buyers. We know from our market research that Skoda owners are incredibly engaged proportionally to their sales. They read a lot of automotive content. They're very active on our forums. It's a brand that really encourages car nuts because they feel like they're kind of in on a little secret that most people aren't in on. And the fact that Skoda understands as buyers enough to go, we can trust them to put the right petrol in the car to be able to run the tech. Whereas Volkswagen goes, there might be a few percent of buyers who don't do the right thing and put 98 RON in their car. It kind of says a lot about Skoda's buyers, that they are people who are willing to kind of go above and beyond what a lot of consumers would. And I think that by reflection actually says a hell of a lot about its brand as well. And then in terms of this vehicle, you try and think of, you know, other potential vehicles you could buy. And yes, there's a Volkswagen Passat All-Track, which is a very good car. But then beyond that, you're going up to things like the Volvo V90 Cross Country or the Mercedes-Benz E-Class All-Terrain, which is six-figure cars. And I would argue that the Superb is 90% as good as those cars for 50% of the price. Pretty compelling product.
I totally agree. And I mean, I love a good wagon. I like a bigger car because, as you'll see in the story, I really like being able to put my bike in the back. In a normal winter, I like being able to pack up and go to the snow. And so having all-wheel drive and all the space of the Superb is a real win. And it's something that not a heap of cars at that price offer. I mean, $60,000 will buy you something like a Hyundai Santa Fe or a Kia Sorento if you want a seven-seat family SUV. But not everyone does want that. And if it was my money, the idea of, for one, the fact that the Superb is a bit quirky and a bit of a niche car really appeals to me, but the idea of being able to buy a big family car with a lot of space that doesn't look like a big family car with a lot of space and doesn't drive like it either. I mean, although it is a really big car and maybe the turning circle is a little bit larger than I would like, nothing else about driving the Superb makes you feel like you're driving a big bus. It fits really neatly in tight underground spaces because it's not too wide. You've got really good visibility out of every angle. And when you put it in sport mode, it handles like a normal wagon as well. So the balance of being able to enjoy the car and also being able to, you know, do all the practical stuff you need to do with a big car is just perfectly nailed in the Superb. That's why Skoda's going to keep it around. The Skoda PR actually said to us on the phone that it just fills a gap that nothing else does. And I think in this case, they're right because the Passat All-Track isn't on sale in Australia at the moment. And yeah, to like Moko said, to get into a V90 cross country or an Audi A6 all road, you're paying a lot more money for realistically not a whole lot more car. So it just slots perfectly into a niche that, I mean, car nerds and motoring journos seem to love. And I wish more buyers loved as well.
Mm-hmm. Apart from the turning circle you just mentioned, was there anything else that you weren't a big fan of?
There are a couple of things. So, I mean, like any car, when you spend more time with it, you get to know it a bit better. One of the things that really annoyed me was the fact that the gesture control on the touchscreen would occasionally skip a song when I reached down to change the climate control. I think that's just down to where the sensor was placed. But you can turn that off, thankfully. So that was one of the first things I did. I think the other thing that I would have liked from it maybe, and this might be wishful thinking given the price of it, but if you look at Skoda's latest products like the Kodiaq SUV, the Scala hatchback and the upcoming Octavia, there's a bit of flair to the interior design that you just don't get in the Superb. I get that this is a big family car and maybe it's not meant to be as interesting or exciting, but I think maybe a little bit more sort of a bit more sparkle inside, some more colorful trim or maybe a wood trim option wouldn't go astray either. And the last very real world, very normal complaint I had is that you can't fit a bottle of champagne in the air-conditioned center console, which, as we've written in our story, is acceptable, but this isn't called the Skoda Acceptable, Mandy.
I love that note. You can keep your eye on carexpert.com.au for that review to lob very soon. Our feature guest this week on Car Expert is from Independent Safety Authority ANCAP, Rhianne Robson, Director for Communications and Advocacy. A very big welcome to you, Rhianne, and thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Mandy. Hi, Scott. Hi, Mike.
Look, we wouldn't mind touching on a few subjects with you during this chat, including autonomous emergency braking, but it might be just nice to start off with the new testing protocols for 2020. For anyone who isn't aware of them, are you able to summarise those for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, 2020 has been a significant step change for ANCAP in terms of our protocols. Every couple of years, we raise the bar, we increase the stringency of our testing, we broaden our testing regime, and 2020 through to 2022 is introducing a whole heap of new things, but also updating some of those existing tests that we've been doing for some time. There's a great video actually explaining each of those changes pinned to the top of our Facebook page, so I'd encourage your listeners to jump on and have a look. One of the key changes for us this year is what we call our MPDB crash test. It stands for Mobile Progressive Deformable Barrier Test, so it's a bit of a mouthful, but essentially it's that bread and butter frontal offset crash that you'll all be familiar with, just notched up a year. So previously we had undertaken that test where the test vehicle would hit a crash barrier, a static one, a concrete block, which mimics the front of an oncoming vehicle, and that barrier was static, it didn't move. This year, under the new regime, the oncoming vehicle is a moving trolley, so it's making it a lot harder for vehicles to pass that test, and it also adds in a new element, what we call vehicle compatibility. So it's looking at the opponent's vehicle and how that will fare based on what is hitting it. So one of the best examples I can give you are the two ratings that we've issued to the 2020 protocols so far this year, the Isuzu D-Max and the Toyota Yaris. Two very different vehicles. One's a big heavy ute and one's a small light car. Of course, they're going to fare differently depending on what they hit. So that's what this test looks to address. With the MPDB compatibility test. There's also a range of other aspects that have been added in for 2020, and one of those is far side impact, and this is where there's quite a bit of interest around the centre airbag. Far side impact testing is where we're looking at the occupants of a vehicle and their interaction with each other. So if you've got a driver and a front seat passenger and you have a side impact crash where somebody T-bones you or you run off the road into a fixed object like a tree or a pole, the two occupants of that vehicle are likely to come together and that can result in some serious injury. The centre airbag is one countermeasure that can be used to mitigate that risk of injury, but it's not actually prescribed. So ANCAP isn't saying that vehicle brands must have a centre airbag. We're saying that if you have a smaller vehicle where space in the cabin is at a premium, you do need a countermeasure to mitigate the risk of that occupant-to-occupant interaction. There's a whole range of other aspects for autonomous emergency braking that have also been added into the mix for 2020, and we'll probably touch on that as we discuss AEB in a bit more detail.
Yeah, well, recently ANCAP proposed the AEB should be mandatory. What role do you think ANCAP plays in influencing manufacturers to include such equipment like this?
ANCAP is a significant influence on the market. We have been for 28 years. But it's important to note that we are a non-regulatory authority. It's the Australian government that prescribes the Australian design rules, and they are the base specifications that a vehicle must meet in order to be sold into Australia. So we have been leading the way. We sort of dangle that carrot, and we take it on as a top two-pronged approach where we are saying to consumers, look for this technology. We're wanting consumers to be confident in the technology that's added, But then that other element from ANCAP's influence is to say to the vehicle brands, well, this is what we believe will save lives on our roads, it will prevent injuries, and we'd like you to introduce the technology into your vehicle as quickly as you can so that we can prevent road trauma from happening.
And this is a bit of a bugbear of mine, is the tendency of automotive manufacturers to all invent different buzzwords and names for their safety systems. I did a survey recently of 32 car brands, and there were 22 different names for fundamentally the same type of autonomous emergency braking system, which to me really muddies the waters and makes it harder for people to know just what technology they're actually getting. Would ANCAP be in favour of some sort of policy to make a bit more clarity around the naming of safety systems so people actually knew what they were getting?
Yeah, look, I've seen that you've had a few articles published in the past few weeks about that, and it's definitely something that ANCAP is working hard with the vehicle brands on. From our perspective, every time we rate a vehicle, we do use a generic term. So we don't go into the proprietary details, the proprietary names. We use those generic and quite simple categorisations of AEB city, which is your lower speed braking system, AEB interurban, which are the higher speed systems capable of braking anywhere between, let's say, 40 to even up to close to 200 kilometres an hour in some vehicle models. We then split it out to AEB VRU, vulnerable road user, which is looking at the systems that are then capable of detecting cyclists and pedestrians. So the generic term is there, and it's always used by ANCAP. So I'd encourage you listeners to jump onto the ANCAP website, because every vehicle we rate is assessed for its capability in those three AEB grades. And we'll be going a little step further in a month or so. We're about to launch a new national advertising campaign. And this is not only looking at autonomous emergency braking, but also lane support systems, the active systems that can avoid a runoff road crash where you might cross over the line marking or onto the road shoulder. The call to action as part of that campaign will be getting consumers to check what AEB systems and what lane support systems are fitted to the vehicle they have. And that will be enhanced through the ANCAP website, where we'll have a very, very simple search tool which will display a green tick if it has it, a red X if it doesn't, and an orange circle, I think it is, if it's an optional feature. So we want to make consumers aware that it is an umbrella term, and while the vehicle brands do have their own proprietary names for these systems, it's important to understand what capability your vehicle has.
Rhianne, ANCAP, as you've said, has obviously, even though it can't regulate, really push the market to better safety systems. But there are some brands that are still a little bit behind the curve. Are there any that really stand out to you, or any cars that really stand out to you as lacking features that they really should now have?
Look, the vehicle brands have done an exceptional job in voluntarily fitting systems like AEB. That has been through ANCAP's influence, but also off their own back. They've got the technology. They're the ones leading the advancement of this these systems. So they need to be commended for that. If we look at some of the most recent sales figures from the end of September, we've now got 67% of all new vehicles sold having AEB as standard, and there's only around 15-16% that aren't offering any form of AEB. So that's where this regulation impact statement and the proposal by the Australian government to mandate these technologies will close that gap. But looking at the top 20 sellers for the month of September, we have a really strong mix. So 19 out of those top 20 have AEB as either standard or optional. And there's only one vehicle in that top 20, and it's actually the 20th sales rank, that doesn't offer AEB as yet. So we're hoping that that vehicle will either be upgraded or replaced in the not too distant future. And that's likely to happen. But it also will be pushed along by that regulation that's proposed to come in the next couple of years.
Rhianne, why do you think some manufacturers choose not to include AEB as standard these days?
Some of the brands haven't yet added AED to their vehicles due to the life cycle of that vehicle. The one that I'm referring to in this top 20 that doesn't yet offer it is a light commercial vehicle, a utility. And generally, they have longer life cycles, longer time in the market. So we'd encourage the vehicle brands to upgrade through mid-cycle production changes. And hopefully this one will be replaced in the not-too-distant future to add AUV to the mix.
I think sometimes it's really, you know, obviously we're always looking forwards to what is coming, but sometimes it's really good to sit back and take stock of where we've come from. And, you know, even 5 years ago, tradies in particular who drove pickup trucks or vans really got the short shrift when it came to safety features. But we've seen two of the most recent scores to the Mazda BT50 and the Isuzu D-Max, both pickups, both absolutely smashing their test out of the park and getting 5 stars. It must be quite edifying for a safety body such as ANCAP to look back at that and realise that you've played a role in making traditionally fairly unsafe vehicles much safer for consumers. That must be quite an edifying position to be in.
Oh, it's excellent. And the vehicle brands like Toyota, Isuzu and Mazda, who were our first 2025 star recipients, really need to be commended for the hard work that they've put in development of those new models over the past couple of years. ANCAP works very closely with vehicle brands. We gazette our protocols ahead of time and we make sure that vehicle brands are in a position to be able to add those newer safety features as quickly as they possibly can. In terms of the light commercial vehicles, so those utilities that you mentioned, Mike, ANCAP doesn't discriminate. We don't have different protocols for LCVs over passenger vehicles, and that's the reason that we have seen great gains in that segment, where they are providing the same levels of safety that you would see across your passenger vehicles and your SUVs.
All right, we might wrap it up there. Rhianne Robson, Director for Communications and Advocacy for ANCAP, we thank you so much for your time. And that brings an end to this week's Car Expert podcast. Some cars in the garage for next week. What can we look forward to, Marco?
Yeah, we've got a pretty diverse mixture. So the most interesting thing I'm seeing in our Melbourne calendar is the new plug-in hybrid Mercedes GLC 300E. Tony up in Sydney is doing the launch of the new generation Peugeot 2008. And Kurt is doing the launch up there of the Toyota Yaris Cross, which is the high-riding small SUV version of its little Yaris. So there's definitely a bit of a theme going on there. And then we're also tying together a pickup comparison test with the new D-Max and BT50 up against the Ranger and Hilux. So a heck of a lot coming through the garage, and we're starting to see things pick up now that some of these restrictions are starting to be walked back.
And, Scully, any content worth highlighting that's coming up on the site next week?
We have an absolutely chockers weekend of features coming up. So once this goes live, they should all be up on carexpert.com.au. I personally really, really enjoyed reading Thanos' story about the Hummer and all its ripoffs. But we've also got a really in-depth story from Will Stopford about Fords you might have forgotten about. A story we did similarly about Holdens was actually the most read bit of content on Car Expert since we launched. Because people are intrigued by Australian brands and what they've done over the years. So, this one I really enjoyed editing and reading, and I think a lot of our readers will as well. And on the reviews front, as this podcast goes live, we have a review of the Alfa Romeo Stelvio 2.2, the facelifted model from Thanos in Greece, and then we've got Moco's LDV Deliver 9 review coming up with a video from Paul this week as well.
Oh, yes. Looking forward to that van review. I thank you, Mike Costello and Scott Colley. Have a lovely weekend and chat next week.
Always a pleasure, Mandy.